Side 2, Gateway, continuing on page 56. They extracted three kinds of blood from me, fingertip, inside of the elbow, and lobe of the ear. I was sure they would all run 90 proof, but it didn't matter. The medical was only a formality. If you could survive the trip up to Gateway by spacecraft in the first place, you could survive a trip on a Heechee ship, unless something went wrong, in which case you probably couldn't survive anyway, no matter how healthy you were. Booklet. Who owns Gateway? Gateway is unique in the history of humanity, and it was quickly realized that it was too valuable a resource to be given to any one group of persons or any one government. Therefore, Gateway Enterprises Incorporated was formed. Gateway Enterprises, usually referred to as the corporation, is a multinational corporation whose general partners are the governments of the United States of America, the Soviet Union, the United States of Brazil, the Venusian Confederation, and New People's Asia, and whose limited partners are all those persons who, like yourself, have signed the attached Memorandum of Agreement. Shower procedure. This shower will automatically deliver two 45-second sprays, soap between sprays. You are entitled to one use of the shower in each 3-day period. Additional showers may be charged against your credit balance at the rate of 45 seconds, $5. End of booklets. I had time for a quick cup of coffee off a cart that someone was tending next to a drop shaft. Private enterprise on Gateway, I hadn't known that existed. And then I got to the first session of the class right on the tick. We met in a big room on level dog, long and narrow and low-ceilinged. The seats were arranged two on each side with a center aisle, sort of like a schoolroom in a converted bus. Sherry came in late, looking fresh and cheerful, and slipped in beside me. Our whole group was there, all seven of us who had come up from Earth together, the family of four from Venus, and a couple others I knew to be new fish like me. "You don't look too bad," Sherry whispered as the instructor pondered over some papers on his desk. "Does the hangover show?" "Actually not, but I assume it's there. I heard you coming in last night. In fact," she added thoughtfully, "the whole tunnel heard you." I winced. I could still smell myself, but most of it was apparently inside me. None of the others seemed to be edging away, not even Sherry. The instructor stood up and studied us thoughtfully for a while. "Oh, well," he said, and looked back at his papers. Then he shook his head. "I won't take attendance," he said. "I teach the course in how to run a Heechee ship." I noticed he had a batch of bracelets. I couldn't count them, but there were at least half a dozen. I wondered briefly about these people I kept seeing who had been out a lot of times and still weren't rich. "This is only one of the three courses you get. After this, you get survival in unfamiliar environments, and then how to recognize what's valuable. But this one is in ship handling. And the way we're going to start learning it is by doing it. All of you, come with me." So we all got up and gaggled after him, out of the room, down a tunnel, onto the down cable of a drop shaft, and past the guards, maybe the same ones who had chased me away the night before. This time, they just nodded to the instructor and watched us go past. We wound up in a long, wide, low-ceiling passage with about a dozen squared-off and stained metal cylinders sticking up out of the floor. They looked like charred tree stumps, and it was a moment before I realized what they were. I gulped. "They're ships," I whispered to Sherry louder than I intended. A couple of people looked at me curiously. One of them, I noticed, was a girl I had danced with the night before, the one with the dense black eyebrows. She nodded to me and smiled. I saw the bangles on her arm and wondered what she was doing there, and how she had done at the gambling tables. The instructor gathered us around him and said, "As someone just said, these are Heechee ships, the lander part. This is the piece you go down to a planet in, if you're lucky enough to find a planet. They don't look very big, but five people can fit into each of those garbage cans you see. Not comfortably exactly, but they can. Generally speaking, of course, you'll always leave one person in the main ship, so there'll be, at most, four in the lander." He led us past the nearest of them, and we all satisfied the impulse to touch, scratch, or pat it. Then he began to lecture. There were 924 of these ships docked at Gateway when it was first explored. About 200, so far, have proved non-operational. Mostly, we don't know why. They just don't work. 304 have actually been sent out on at least one trip. 33 of those are here now and available for prospecting trips. The others haven't been tried yet. He hiked himself up on the stumpy cylinder and sat there while he went on. One thing you have to decide is whether you want to take one of the 33 tested ones or one of the ones that has never been flown. By human beings, I mean. There, you just pay your money and take your choice. It's a gamble either way. A high proportion of the trips that didn't come back were in first flights, so there's obviously some risk there. Well, that figures, doesn't it? After all, nobody has done any maintenance on them for God knows how long since the Hee Chee put them there. On the other hand, there's a risk in the ones that have been out and back safely, too. There's no such thing as perpetual motion. We think some of the no returns have been because the ships ran out of fuel. Trouble is, we don't know what the fuel is, or how much there is, or how to tell when a ship is about to run out. He patted the stump. This and all the others you see here were designed for 5 Hee Chees in the cruise, as far as we can tell, but we send them out with 3 human beings. It seems the Hee Chee were more tolerant of each other's company in confined spaces than people are. There are bigger and smaller ships, but the no-return rate on them has been very bad the last couple of orbits. It's probably just a string of bad luck, but anyway, I personally would stick with a 3. You people, you do what you want. So you come to your second choice, which is who you go with. Keep your eyes open. Look for companions. What? Sherry had been semaphoring her hand until she got his attention. You said very bad, she said. How bad is that? The instructor said patiently, in the last physical orbit, about 3 out of 10 fives came back. Those are the biggest ships. In several cases, the crews were dead when we got them open, even so. Yeah, said Sherry, that's very bad. No, that's not bad at all compared to the one-man ships. 2 orbits ago, we went a whole orbit, and only 2 ones came back at all. That's bad. Why is that? Asked the father of the Tunnel Rat family. Their name was Forehand. The instructor looked at him for a moment. If you ever find out, he said, be sure and tell somebody. Now, as far as selecting a crew is concerned, you're better off if you can get somebody who's already been out. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. Prospectors who strike it rich generally quit. The ones that are still hungry may not want to break up their teams. So a lot of you fish are going to have to go out with other virgins. He looked around thoughtfully. Well, let's get our feet wet. Sort yourselves out into groups of 3. Don't worry about who's in your group. This isn't where you pick your partners. And climb into one of those open landers. Don't touch anything. They're supposed to be in deactive mode, but I have to tell you, they don't always stay deactive. Just go in, climb down to the control cabin, and wait for an instructor to join you. That was the first I'd heard that there were other instructors. I looked around, trying to work out which were teachers and which were fish. Well, he said, are there any questions? Sherry again. Yeah. What's your name? Did I forget that again? I'm Jimmy Joe. Pleased to meet you all. Now, let's go. Now I know a lot more than my instructor did, including what happened to him half an orbit later. Poor old Jimmy Joe. He went out before I did and came back while I was on my second trip. Very dead. Flare burns, they say. His eyes were boiled out of his head. But at that time he knew it all, and it was all very strange and wonderful to me. So we crawled into the funny elliptical hatch that let you slip between the thrusters and down into the landing capsule, and then down a peg ladder, one step further into the main vehicle itself. We looked around, 3 Alibabas staring at the treasure cave. We heard a scratching above us, and a head poked in. It had shaggy eyebrows and pretty eyes, and it belonged to the girl I had been dancing with the night before. Having fun? She inquired. We were clinging together as far from anything that looked movable as we could get, and I doubt we really looked at ease. Never mind, she said. Just look around. Get familiar with it. You'll see a lot of it. That vertical line of wheels with the little spokes sticking out of them, that's the target selector. That's the most important thing not to touch for now, maybe ever. That golden spiral thing over next to you there, the blonde girl? Anybody want to guess what that's for? You there, blonde girl, who was one of the Forehand daughters, shrank away from it and shook her head. I shook mine, but Sherry hazarded, could it be a hat rack? Teacher squinted at it thoughtfully. No, I don't think so. But I keep hoping one of you fish will know the answer. None of us here do. It gets hot, sometimes in flight. Nobody knows why. The toilet's in there. You're going to have a lot of fun with that. But it does work, after you learn how. You can sling your hammocks and sleep there, or anywhere you want to, actually. That corner and that recess are pretty dead space. If you're in a crew that wants some privacy, you can screen them off. A little bit, anyway. Sherry said, don't any of you people like to tell your names? Teacher grinned. I'm Jael Clara Moynlin. You want to know the rest about me? I've been out twice and didn't score, and I'm killing time until the right trip comes along, so I work as assistant instructor. How do you know which is the right trip? Asked the Forehand girl. Bright fellow, you. Good question. That's another of those questions that I like to hear you ask because it shows you're thinking. But if there's an answer, I don't know what it is. Let's see. You already know this ship is a 3. It's done 6 round trips already, but it's a reasonable bet that it's got enough reserve fuel for a couple more. I'd rather take it than a 1. That's for long shot gamblers. Mr. Joe said that, said the Forehand girl. But my father says he's been all through the records since Orbit 1, and the 1s aren't that bad. Your father can have mine, said Jael Clara Moynlin. It's not just statistics. 1s are lonesome. Anyway, one person can't really handle everything. If you hit lucky, you need shipmates. One in orbit? Most of us keep one man in a ship, feel safer that way. At least somebody might get help if things go rancid. So 2 of you go down in the lander to look around. Of course, if you do hit lucky, you have to split it 3 ways. If you hit anything big, there's plenty to go around. And if you don't hit, 1/3 of nothing is no less than all of it. Wouldn't it be even better in a 5, then? I asked. Clara looked at me and half-winked. I hadn't thought she remembered dancing the night before. Maybe, maybe not. The thing about 5s is that they have almost unlimited target acceptance. Please talk English, Sherry coaxed. 5s will accept a lot of destinations that 3s and 1s won't. I think it's because some of those destinations are dangerous. The worst ship I ever saw come back was a 5. All scarred and seared and bent. Nobody knows how it made it back at all. Nobody knows where it had been either, but I heard somebody say it might have actually been in the photosphere of a star. The crew couldn't tell us. They were dead. Of course, she went on meditatively, an armored 3 has almost as much target acceptance as a 5, but you take your chances any way you swing. Now, let's get with it, shall we? You, she pointed at Sherry, sit down over there. The Forehand girl and I crawled around the mix of human and Heechee furnishings to make room. There wasn't much. If you cleared everything out of a 3, you'd have a room about 4 meters by 3 by 3. But of course, if you cleared everything out, it wouldn't go. Sherry sat down in front of the column of spoked wheels, wriggling her bottom to try to get a fit. What kind of behinds did the Heechee have? She complained. Teacher said, another good question. Same no good answer. If you find out, tell us. The corporation puts that webbing in the seat. It isn't original equipment. Okay, now that thing you're looking at is the target selector. Put your hand on one of the wheels, any one. Just don't touch any other. Now move it. She peered down anxiously as Sherry touched the bottom wheel, then thrust with her fingers, then laid the heel of her hand on it, braced herself against the V-shaped arms of the seat, and shoved. Finally, it moved, and the lights along the row of wheels began to flicker. Wow, said Sherry. They must have been pretty strong. We took turns trying with that one wheel. Clara wouldn't let us touch any other that day. And when it came my turn, I was surprised to find that it took about as much muscle as I could bring to bear to make it move. It didn't feel rusted stuck. It felt as though it were meant to be hard to turn. And when you think how much trouble you can get into if you turn a setting by accident in the middle of a flight, it probably was. Booklet. What does the corporation do? The purpose of the corporation is to exploit the spacecraft left by the Heechee and to trade in, develop, or otherwise utilize all artifacts, goods, raw materials, or other things of value discovered by means of these vessels. The corporation encourages commercial development of Heechee technology and grants leases on a royalty basis for this purpose. Its revenues are used to pay appropriate shares to limited partners such as you, who have been instrumental in discovering new things of value, to pay the costs of maintaining Gateway itself over and above the per capita tax contribution, to pay to each of the general partners an annual sum sufficient to cover the cost of maintaining surveillance by means of the space cruisers you will have observed in orbit nearby, to create and maintain an adequate reserve for contingencies, and to use the balance of its income to subsidize research and development on the objects of value themselves. In the fiscal year ending February 30 last, the total revenues of the corporation exceeded 3.7 times 10 to the 12th power dollars U.S. Gateway's ships. The vessels available on Gateway are capable of interstellar flight at speeds greater than the velocity of light. The means of propulsion is not understood. See pilot manual. There is also a fairly conventional rocket propulsion system using liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen for attitude control and for propulsion of the landing craft, which is docked into each interstellar vessel. There are three major classifications, designated as Class 1, Class 3, and Class 5, according to the number of persons they can carry. Some of the vessels are of particularly heavy construction and are designated armored. Most of the armored class are fives. Each vessel is programmed to navigate itself automatically to a number of destinations. Return is automatic and is quite reliable in practice. Your course in ship handling will adequately prepare you for all the necessary tasks in piloting your vessel safely. However, see pilot manual for safety regulations. End booklet. Of course, now I know more about that, too, than my teacher did then. Not that I'm so smart, but it has taken, and is still taking, a lot of people a hell of a long time to figure out what goes on just in setting up a target on the course director. What it is a vertical row of number generators. The lights that show up display numbers. That's not easy to see, because they don't look like numbers. They aren't positional or decimal. Apparently, the Heechee expressed numbers as sums of primes and exponents, but all that's way over my head. Only the check pilots and the course programmers working for the corporation really have to be able to read the numbers. And they don't do it directly, only with a computing translator. The first five digits appear to express the position of the target in space, reading from bottom to top. Dane Michnikoff says the prime ordering isn't from bottom to top, but from front to back, which says something or other about the Heechee. They were 3D-oriented like primitive man instead of 2D-oriented like us. You would think that three numbers would be enough to describe any position anywhere in the universe, wouldn't you? I mean, if you make a three-dimensional representation of the galaxy, you can express any point in it by means of a number for each of the three dimensions. But it took the Heechee five. Does that mean there were five dimensions that were perceptible to the Heechee? Metchnikoff says not. Anyway, once you get a lock on the first five numbers, the other seven can be turned to quite arbitrary settings, and you'll still go when you squeeze the action teat. What you usually do, or what the course programmers the corporation keeps on the payroll to do this sort of thing for you usually do, is pick four numbers at random. Then you cycle the fifth digit until you get a kind of warning pink glow. Sometimes it's faint, sometimes it's bright. If you stop there and press the flat oval part under the teat, the other numbers begin to creep around, just a couple of millimeters one way or another, and the pink glow gets brighter. When they stop, it's shocking pink and shockingly bright. Metchnikoff says that's an automatic fine-tuning device. The machine allows for Heechee air, so when you get close to a real valid target setting, it makes the final adjustments for you automatically. Probably he's right. Of course, learning every step of this costs a lot of time and money, and most of it costs some lives. It's dangerous being a prospector, but for the first few out, it was more like suicidal. Sometimes you can cycle all the way to your fifth digit and get nothing at all. So what you do is you swear. Then you reset one of the other four and go again. It only takes a few seconds to cycle, but Czech pilots have run up 100 hours of new settings before they got good color. Of course, by the time I went out, the Czech pilots and the course programmers had worked out a couple hundred possible settings that had been logged as good color, but not as yet used, as well as all the settings that had been used and aren't worth going back to, or that the crews didn't come back from. But all that, I didn't know at the time. And when I sat down in that modified Heechee seat, it was all new. And I don't know if I can make you understand what it felt like. I mean, there I was, in a seat where Heechee had sat 500,000 years ago. The thing in front of me was a target selector. The ship could go anywhere. If I selected the right target, I could find myself around Sirius, Procyon, maybe even the Magellanic Clouds. Teacher got tired of hanging head down and wriggled through, squeezing in behind me. "Your turn, Broadhead," she said, resting a hand on my shoulder and what felt like her breasts on my back. I was reluctant to touch. I asked, "Isn't there any way of telling where you're going to wind up?" "Probably," she said, "providing you're a Heechee with pilot training."
"Not even like one color means you're going farther from here than some other color?"
"Not that anybody here has figured out. Of course, they keep trying. There's a whole team that spends its time programming return mission reports against the settings they went out with. So far, they've come up empty. Now, let's get on with it, Broadhead. Put your whole hand on that first wheel, the one the others have used. Shove it. It'll take more muscle than you think." It did. In fact, I was almost afraid to push it hard enough to make it work. She leaned over and put her hand on mine, and I realized that that nice musk oil smell that had been in my nostrils for the last little while was hers. It wasn't just musk, either. Her pheromones were snuggling nicely into my chemoreceptors. It made a very nice change from the rest of the gateway stink. But all the same, I didn't get even a show of color, although I tried for 5 minutes before she waved me away and gave Sherry another shot in my place. Booklet. Safety Rules for Gateway Ships. The mechanism for interstellar travel is known to be contained in the diamond-shaped box which is located under the center keel of three-man and five-man ships and in the sanitary facilities of the one-man ships. No one has successfully opened one of those containers. Each attempt has resulted in explosion of approximately 1 kiloton force. A major research project is attempting to penetrate this box without destroying it, and if you as a limited partner have any information or suggestions in this connection, you should contact a corporation officer at once. However, under no circumstances attempt to open the box yourself. Tampering with it in any way, or docking a vessel on which the box has been tampered with, is strictly forbidden. The penalty is forfeiture of all rights and immediate expulsion from Gateway. The course-directing equipment also poses a potential danger. Under no circumstances should you attempt to change the setting once you have begun your flight. No vessel in which this has been done has ever returned.
End of booklet. When I got back to my room, somebody had cleaned it up. I wondered gratefully who that had been, but I was too tired to wonder very long. Until you get used to it, low gravity can be exhausting. You find yourself overusing all your muscles because you have to relearn a whole pattern of economies.
I slung my hammock and was just dozing off when I heard a scratching at the lattice of my door and Sherry's voice. "Bob?"
"What? Are you asleep?"
Obviously I wasn't, but I interpreted the question the way she had intended it.
"No, I've been lying here thinking."
"So was I. Bob?"
"Yeah?"
"Would you like me to come into your hammock?"
I made an effort to wake myself up enough to consider the question on its merits.
"I really want to," she said.
"All right. Sure. I mean, glad to have you."
She slipped into my room and I slid over in the hammock, which swung slowly as she crawled into it. She was wearing a knitted t-shirt and underpants, and she felt warm and soft against me when we rolled gently together in the hollow of the hammock.
"It doesn't have to be sex, Stud," she said. "I'm easy either way. Let's see what develops. Are you scared?"
Her breath was the sweetest smelling thing about her. I could feel it on my cheek, a lot more than I thought I would be.
"Why?"
"Bob," she squirmed herself comfortable and then twisted her neck to look at me over her shoulder. "You know, you say kind of asshole things sometimes."
"Sorry." Well, I mean it. I mean, look what we're doing. We're going to get into a ship that we don't know if it's going to get where it's supposed to go, and we don't even know where it's supposed to go. We go faster than light. Nobody knows how. We don't know how long we'll be gone, even if we knew where we were going. So we could be traveling the rest of our lives and die before we got there, even if we didn't run into something that would kill us in 2 seconds. Right? Right. So how come you ask me why I'm scared? Just making conversation, I curled up along her back and cupped a breast, not aggressively, but because it felt good. Not only that, we don't know anything about the people who built these things. How do we know this isn't all a practical joke on their part? Maybe their way of luring fresh meat into Heechy Heaven. We don't, I agreed. Roll over this way. And the ship they showed us this morning doesn't hardly look like I thought it was going to be at all, she said, doing as I told her and putting a hand on the back of my neck. There was a sharp whistle from somewhere. I couldn't tell where. What's that? I don't know. It came again, sounding both out in the tunnel and louder inside my room. Oh, it's the phone. What I was hearing was my own Paizo phone and the ones on either side of me, all ringing at once. The whistle stopped, and there was a voice. This is Jim Joe. All you fish who want to see what a ship looks like when it comes back after a bad trip, come to docking station 4. They're bringing it in now. I could hear a murmuring from the forehands room next door, and I could feel Sherry's heart pounding. We'd better go, I said. I know, but I don't think I want to much. The ship had made it back to Gateway, but not quite all the way. One of the orbiting cruisers had detected it and closed in on it. Now a tug was bringing it into the corporation's own docks, where usually only the rockets from the planets latched in. There was a hatch big enough to hold even a 5. This was a 3. What there was left of it.
Oh, sweet Jesus, Sherry whispered. Bob, what do you suppose happened to them?
To the people? They died. There was not really any doubt of that. The ship was a wreck. The lander stem was gone. Just the interstellar vehicle itself, the mushroom cap, was still there. And that was bent out of shape, split open, seared by heat. Split open. Heechy metal that doesn't even soften under an electric arc. But we hadn't seen the worst of it. We never did see the worst of it. We only heard about it. One man was still inside the ship, all over the inside of the ship. He had been literally spattered around the control room, and his remains had been baked onto the walls. By what? Heat and acceleration, no doubt. Perhaps he had found himself skipping into the upper reaches of a sun or in tight orbit around a neutron star. The differential in gravity might have shredded ship and crew like that, but we never knew. The other two persons in the crew were not there at all. Not that it was easy to tell, but the census of the organs revealed only one jaw, one pelvis, one spine, though in many short pieces. Perhaps the other two had been in the lander. Move it, fish. Sherry cut my arm and pulled me out of the way. 5 uniformed crewmen from the cruisers came through in American and Brazilian blue, Russian beige, Venusian work white, and Chinese all-purpose black and brown. The American and the Venusian were female. The faces were all different, but the expressions were all the same mixture of discipline and distaste. Let's go. Sherry tugged me away. She didn't want to watch the crewmen poke through the remnants, and neither did I. The whole class, Jimmy Joe, Clara, and the other teachers and all, began to straggle back to our rooms. Not quite quick enough. We had been looking through the ports into the lock. When the patrol from the cruisers opened it, we got a whiff of the air inside. I don't know how to describe it. A little bit like overripe garbage being cooked to swill to pigs. Even in the rank air of Gateway, that was hard to take. Teacher dropped off at her own level, down pretty low in the high-rent district around easy level. When she looked up after me as I said goodnight, I observed for the first time that she was crying. Sherry and I said goodnight to the forehands at their door, and I turned to her, but she was ahead of me. I think I'll sleep this one out, she said. Sorry, Bob, but, you know, I just don't feel like it anymore. Classifieds. How do you know you're not a Unitarian? Gateway Fellowship now forming. 87-539. Philetus wanted for Sappho and Lesbia. Joint trips till we make it, then happily ever after in Northern Ireland. permitted, try marriage only. 87-033 or 87-034. Store your effects. Save rent. Avoid corporation seizure while out. Fee includes disposal instructions if non-returned. 88-125. End classifieds. Chapter 9. I don't know why I keep going back to Siegfried von Schrenk. My appointment with him is always on a Wednesday afternoon, and he doesn't like it if I drink or dope before then, so it blows the whole day. I pay a lot for those days. You don't know what it costs to live the way I live. My apartment over Washington Square is $18,000 a month. My residence taxes to live under the big bubble come to another $3,000 plus. It doesn't cost that much to stay on Gateway. I've got some pretty hefty charge accounts for furs, wine, lingerie, jewelry, flowers. Siegfried says I try to buy love. All right, I do. What's wrong with that? I can afford it. And that's not mentioning what full medical costs me. Siegfried, though, comes free. I'm covered by the full medical for psychiatric therapy, any variety I like. I could have group grope or internal massage for the same price, namely nothing. I kid him about that sometimes. Even considering that you're just a bag of rusty bolts, I say, you're not much good, but your price is right. He asks, does that make you feel that you yourself are more valuable if you say that I'm not? Not particularly. Then why do you insist on reminding yourself that I'm a machine, or that I don't cost anything, or that I cannot transcend my programming? I guess you just piss me off, Siegfried. I know that won't satisfy him, so I explain it. You ruined my morning. This friend, Esya Lavrovna, stayed over last night. She's something. So I tell Siegfried a little bit about what Esya is like, including what she is like walking away from me in stretch pants with that long, dirty gold hair hanging down to her waist. She sounds very nice, Siegfried comments. Bet your bolts. Only thing is, she wakes up slow in the morning, just when she was getting lively again. I had to leave my summer place up over Tappan Sea and come down here. Do you love her, Bob? The answer is no, so I want him to think it's yes. I say, no. I think that's an honest answer, Rob, he says approvingly and disappointingly. Is that why you're angry with me? Oh, I don't know. Just in a bad mood, I guess. Can you think of any reasons why? He waits me out, so after a while I say, well, I took a licking at roulette last night. More than you can afford? Christ, no. But it's annoying all the same. There are other things, too. It's getting toward that chilly time of year. My place over Tappan Sea isn't under the bubble, so sitting out on the porch with S.Y.A. for brunch wasn't such a good idea. I don't want to mention this to Siegfried. He would say something wholly rational like, well, why didn't I have my lunch served indoors? And I would just have to tell him all over again that when I was a kid, it was my dream to own a summer place over Tappan Sea and have brunch on the porch looking out over it. They'd just dammed the Hudson then when I was about maybe 12. I used to dream a lot about making it big and living in the style of the rich folks. Well, he's heard all that. Siegfried clears his throat. Thank you, Bob, he says, to let me know that the hour is over. Will I see you next week? Don't you always? I say, smiling. How the time flies. Actually, I wanted to leave a little early today. Did you, Bob? I have another date with S.Y.A., I explain. She's coming back up to the summer place with me tonight. Frankly, what she's going to do is better therapy than what you do. He says, is that all you want out of a relationship, Robbie? You mean just sex? The answer in this case is no. But I don't want him to know just what it is I do want out of my relationship with S.Y.A. Lavrovna. I say, she's a little different from most of my girlfriends, Siegfried. She has about as much clout as I do, for one thing. Has a damn good job. I admire her. Well, I don't particularly, or rather I don't care much about whether I admire her or not. S.Y.A. has one trait that impresses me even more than possessing the sweetest rear view that God ever laid on a human female. Her damn good job is in information handling. She went to the Akademigorsk University. She was a fellow at the Max Planck Institute for Machine Intelligence, and she teaches graduate students in the AI department at NYU. She knows more about Siegfried than Siegfried knows about himself. and that suggests interesting possibilities to me. Chapter 10. Along about my fifth day on Gateway, I got up early and splurged. Breakfast out in the Heechee Town Arms, surrounded by tourists, bloody-eyed gamblers from the casino across the spindle, and liberty sailors from the cruisers. It felt luxurious, and cost luxurious, too. It was worth it because of the tourists. I could feel their eyes on me. I knew they were talking about me, particularly a smooth-faced but old African type, Dahomian or Ghanaian, I think, with his very young, very plump, very jeweled wife. Or whatever. As far as they could tell, I was a swashbuckling hero. True, I didn't have any bangles on my arm, but some of the veterans didn't wear them either. I basked. I considered ordering real eggs and bacon, but that was a little more than even my euphoria would let me go for, so I settled for orange juice. It turned out to be real, to my surprise, and a brioche and several cups of black Danish coffee. All I was really missing was a pretty girl across the arm board of the chair. There were two nice-looking women who seemed to be the Liberty crew from the Chinese cruiser, neither of them unwilling to exchange a few radio messages by the glance of the eyes, but I decided to keep them as open prospects for some future date and paid my check. That was painful enough, and left for class. On the way down, I caught up with the forehands. The man, whose name seemed to be Sess, dropped off the down cable and waited to wish me a polite good morning. "We didn't see you at breakfast," his wife mentioned, so I told them where I had been. The younger daughter, Lois, looked faintly envious. Her mother caught the expression and patted her. "Don't worry, hon. We'll eat there before we go back to Venus." To me, we have to watch our pennies right now, but when we hit, we've got some pretty big plans for spending the profits. "Don't we all?" I said. But something was turning over in my head. "Are you really going to go back to Venus?" "Certainly," they all said in one way or another, and acted surprised at the question, which surprised me. I hadn't realized that tunnel rats could manage to think of that molten stink pot as home. Sess Forehand must have read my expression, too. They were a reserved family, but they didn't miss much. He grinned and said, "It's our home, after all. So is Gateway, in a way." That was astonishing. Actually, we're related to the first man to find Gateway, Sylvester Macklin. You've heard of him? How could I not? He was a sort of a cousin. I guess you know the whole story. I started to say I did, but he obviously was proud of his cousin, and I couldn't blame him. And so I heard a slightly different version of the familiar legend. He was in one of the South Pole tunnels and found a ship. God knows how he got it to the surface, but he did. And he got in and evidently squeezed the go-teat, and it went where it was programmed, here. "Doesn't the corporation pay a royalty?" I asked. "I mean, if they're going to pay for discoveries, what discovery would be more worth paying for?" "Not to us, anyway," said Louise Forehand, somewhat somberly. Money was a hard subject with the Forehands. Of course, Sylvester didn't set out to find Gateway. As you know from what we've been hearing in class, the ships have automatic return. Wherever you go, you just squeeze the go-teat, and you come straight back here. Only that didn't help Sylvester, because he was here. It was the return leg of a round trip with about a zillion-year stopover. "He was smart and strong," Sess took up the story. "You have to be to explore." So he didn't panic. But by the time anybody came out here to investigate, he was out of life support. He could have lived a little longer. He could have used the LOX and H2 from the lander tanks for air and water. I used to wonder why he didn't. "Because he would have starved anyway," Louise cut in, defending her relative. "I think so. Anyway, they found his body, with his notes in his hand. He had cut his throat." They were nice people, but I had heard all this, and they were making me late for class. Of course, class wasn't all that exciting, just at that point. We were up to hammock slinging, basic, and toilet flushing, advanced. You may wonder why they didn't spend more time actually teaching us how to fly the ships. That's simple. The things flew themselves, as the Forehands and everybody else had been telling me. Even the landers were no sweat to operate, although they did require a hand on the controls. Once you were in the lander, all you had to do was compare a 3D sort of holographic representation of the immediate area of space with where you wanted to go, and maneuver a point of light in the tank to the point you wanted to reach. The lander went there. It calculated its own trajectories and corrected its own deviations. It took a little muscular coordination to get the hang of twisting that point of light to where you wanted it to go, but it was a forgiving system. Between the sessions of fleshing practice and hammock drill, we talked about what we were going to do when we graduated. The launch schedules were kept up to date and displayed on the PV monitor in our class whenever anyone pushed the button. Some of them had names attached to them, and one or two of the names I recognized. Tiki Trumbull was a girl I had danced with and sat next to in the mess hall once or twice. She was an out pilot, and as she needed crew, I thought of joining her. But the wise heads told me that out missions were a waste of time. I should tell you what an out pilot is. He's the guy who ferries fresh crews to Gateway 2. There are about a dozen fives that do that as a regular run. They take four people out, which would be what Tiki wanted people for, and then the pilot comes back alone, or with returning prospectors, if any, and what they found. Usually there's somebody. The team who found Gateway 2 are the ones we all dreamed about. They made it. Man, did they make it. Gateway 2 was another gateway, nothing more or less, except that it happened to orbit around a star other than our own. There was not much more in the way of treasure on Gateway 2 than there was on our own gateway. The Heechee had swept everything pretty clean, except for the ships themselves, and there weren't nearly as many ships there, only about 150, compared to almost 1,000 on our old original solar gateway. But 150 ships are worth finding all by themselves, not to mention the fact that they accept some destinations that our local gateway ships don't appear to. The ride out to Gateway 2 seems to be about 400 light years and takes 109 days each way. 2's principal star is a bright blue B-type. They think it is Alcyone in the Pleiades, but there is some doubt. Well, actually, that's not Gateway 2's real star. It doesn't orbit the big one, but a little cinder of a red dwarf nearby. They say the dwarf is probably a distant binary with the blue B, but they also say it shouldn't be because of the difference in ages of the two stars. Give them a few more years to argue, and they'll probably know. One wonders why the Heechee would have put their space lines junction in orbit around so undistinguished a star, but one wonders a lot about the Heechee. However, all that doesn't affect the pocketbook of the team who happened to find the place. They get a royalty on everything that any later prospector finds. I don't know what they've made so far, but it has to be in the tens of millions apiece. Maybe the hundreds. And that's why it doesn't pay to go with an outpilot. You don't really have a much better chance of scoring, and you have to split what you get. So we went down the list of upcoming launches and hashed them over in the light of our five-day expertise, which wasn't much. We appealed to Gilles Clara Moynlin for advice. After all, she'd been out twice. She studied the list of flights and names, pursing her lips. Terry Yakimura's a decent guy, she said. I don't know Parduk, but it might be worth taking a chance on that one. Lay off Dorlian's flight. There's a $1 million bonus, but what they don't tell you is that they've got a bastard control board in it. The corporation's experts have put in a computer that's supposed to override the Heechee target selector, and I wouldn't trust it. And, of course, I wouldn't recommend the one in any circumstances. Lois Forehand asked, which one would you take? If it was up to you, Clara. She scowled thoughtfully, rubbing that dark left eyebrow with the tips of her fingers. Maybe Terry. Well, any of them. But I'm not going out again for a while. I wanted to ask her why, but she turned away from the screen and said, all right, gang, let's get back to the drill. Remember, up for pee, down, close, wait 10, and up for poo. PV monitor display. Launch availabilities, 30-107, 5, 3 vacancies, English-speaking, Terry Yakimura, phone 83-675, or Jay Parduk, 83-004, 30-108, 3, armored, 1 vacancy, English or French, bonus trip, Dorlian Segru, P-phone 88-108, 30-109. 1. Check trip. Good safety record. See launch captain. 30-110. 1. Armored. Bonus trip. See launch captain. 30-111. 3. Open enlistment. See launch captain. 30-112. 3. Probable short trip. Open enlistment. Minimum guarantee. See launch captain. 30-113. 1. 4 vacancies via Gateway 2. Transportation in Reliable 5. Tiki Trumbull. Phone 87-869. End TV monitor display. I celebrated completing the week on ship handling by offering to buy Dane Metchnikoff a drink. That wasn't my first intention. My first intention had been to buy Sherry a drink and drink it in bed. But she was off somewhere, so I worked the buttons on the Paizo phone and got Metchnikoff. He sounded surprised at my offer. "Thanks," he said, and then considered. "Tell you what, give me a hand carrying some stuff, and then I'll buy you a drink." So I went down to his place, which was only one level below Babe. His room was not much better than my own, and bare, except for a couple of full carry-alls. He looked at me almost friendly. "You're a prospector now," he grunted. "Not really. I've got two more courses." "Well, this is the last you see of me, anyway. I'm shipping out with Terry Yakimura tomorrow." I was surprised. "Didn't you just get back, like 10 days ago?" "You can't make any money hanging around here. All I was waiting for was the right crew. You want to come to my farewell party? Terry's place, 2000. "That sounds fine," I said. "Can I bring Sherry?" "Oh, sure. She's coming anyway, I think. Buy you the drink there, if you don't mind. Give me a hand, and we'll get this stuff stored." He had accumulated a surprising amount of goods. I wondered how he had managed to stash them all away in a room as tiny as my own. 3 fabric carriers all stuffed full, hollow disks and a viewer, book tapes, and a few actual books. I took the carriers. On Earth, they would have weighed more than I could handle, probably 50 or 60 kilos. But of course, on Gateway, lifting them was no problem. It was only tugging them through the corridors and jockeying them down the shafts that was tricky. I had the mass, but Metchnikoff had the problems. Since what he was carrying was in odd shapes and varying degrees of fragility, it was about an hour's haul, actually. We wound up in a part of the asteroid I'd never seen before, where an elderly Pakistani woman counted the pieces, gave Metchnikoff a receipt, and began dragging them away down a thickly vine-grown corridor. "Phew," he grunted. "Well, thanks. You're welcome." We started back toward a drop shaft and making conversation, I assume out of some recognition that he owed me a social favor and should practice some social skills. He said, "So, how was the course?" "You mean apart from the fact that I've just finished it and still don't have any idea how to fly those goddamn ships?" "Of course you don't," he said irritably. "The course isn't going to teach you that. It just gives you the general idea. The way you learn, you do it. Only hard part's the lander, of course. Anyway, you've got your issue of tapes?" "Oh, yes." There were 6 cassettes of them. Each of us had been given a set when we completed the first week's course. They had everything that had been said, plus a lot of stuff about different kinds of controls that the corporation might or might not fit on a Hitchi board, and so on. "So play them over," he said. "If you've got any sense, you'll take them with you when you ship out. Got plenty of time to play them then. Mostly the ships fly themselves anyway." "They'd better," I said, doubting it. "So long." He waved and dropped onto the down cable without looking back. Apparently, I had agreed to take the drink he owed me at the party, where it wouldn't cost him anything. I thought of looking for Sherry again, and decided against it. I was in a part of Gateway I didn't know, and, of course, I'd left my map back in my room. I drifted along, more or less at random, past star points where some of the tunnels smelled musty and dusty, and there weren't many people, then through an inhabited section that seemed to be mostly Eastern European. I didn't recognize the languages, but there were little notes and wall signs hanging from the everywhere growing ivy. There were an alphabet that looked Cyrillic, or even stranger. I came to a drop shaft, thought for a moment, and then caught hold of the up cable. The easy way not to be lost on Gateway is to go up until you get to the spindle, where up ends. But this time I found myself passing Central Park, and on impulse, dropped off the up cable to sit by a tree for a while. Central Park isn't really a park. It's a large tunnel, not far from the center of rotation of the asteroid, which has been devoted to vegetation. I found orange trees there, which explained the juice, and grapevines, and ferns, and mosses, but no grass. I'm not sure why. Probably it has something to do with planting only varieties that are sensitive to the available light, mostly the blue gleam from the heechy metal all around, and perhaps they couldn't find a grass that could use it efficiently for its photochemistry. The principal reason for having Central Park in the first place was to suck up CO2 and give back oxygen. That was before they spread planting all over the tunnels. But it also killed smells, or anyway it was supposed to, a little, and it grew a certain amount of food. The whole thing was maybe 80 meters long and twice as tall as I was. It was broad enough to have room for some winding paths. The stuff they grew in looked a lot like good old genuine earthside dirt. What it was, really, was a humus made out of the sewage sludge from the couple of thousand people who had used Gateway toilets. But you couldn't tell that by looking at it, or by smelling it, either. The first tree, big enough to sit by, was no good for that purpose. It was a mulberry, and under it were spread out sheets of fine netting to catch the dropping fruit. I walked past it, and down the path there were a woman and a child.
A child? I hadn't known there were any children on Gateway.
She was a little bit of a thing, maybe a year and a half, playing with a ball so big and so lazy in the light gravity that it was like a balloon. Hello, Bob. That was the other surprise. The woman who greeted me was Jael Clara Moylan. I said without thinking, I didn't know you had a little girl. I don't. This is Kathy Francis, and her mother lets me borrow her sometimes. Kathy, this is Bob Broadhead. Hello, Bob, the little thing called, studying me from 3 meters away. Are you a friend of Clara's? I hope so. She's my teacher. Do you want to play catch? Kathy finished her study of me and said precisely each word separate from the one before it, and as clearly formed as an adult's, I don't know how to play catch, but I will get 6 mulberries for you. That's all you can have. Thank you. I slumped down next to Clara, who was hugging her knees and watching the child. She's cute. Well, I guess so. It's hard to judge when there aren't very many other children around. She's not a prospector, is she? I wasn't exactly joking, but Clara laughed warmly. Her parents are a permanent party. Well, most of the time. Right now, her mother's off prospecting. They do that sometimes, a lot of them. You can spend just so much time trying to figure out what the Heechee were up to before you want to try your own solutions to the puzzles. Sounds dangerous. She shushed me. Kathy came back with 3 of my mulberries in each open hand so as not to crush them. She had a funny way of walking, which didn't seem to use much of the thigh and calf muscles. She sort of pushed herself up on the ball of each foot in turn and let herself float to the next step. After I figured that out, I tried it for myself, and it turned out to be a pretty efficient way of walking in near zero gravity, but my reflexes kept lousing it up. I suppose you have to be born on Gateway to come by it naturally. Clara in the park was a lot more relaxed and feminine than Clara the teacher. The eyebrows that had looked masculine and angry became outdoorsy and friendly. She still smelled very nice. It was pretty pleasant chatting with her while Kathy stepped daintily around us, playing with her ball. We compared places we'd been and didn't find any in common. The one thing we did find in common was that I was born almost the same day as her 2-year younger brother. Did you like your brother? I asked, a gambit played for the hell of it. Well, sure, he was the baby, but he was an Aries, born under Mercury and the moon. Made him fickle and moody, of course. I think he would have had a complicated life. I was less interested in asking her about what happened to him than in asking if she really believed in that garbage, but that didn't seem tactful. And anyway, she went on talking. I'm a Sagittarius myself, and you... Oh, of course. You must be the same as Davy.
I guess so, I said, being polite. I don't go much for astrology.
Not astrology. Gynepleology. One's superstition, the other's science.
Hmm.
She laughed. I can see you're a scoffer. Doesn't matter. If you believe, all right. If you don't, well, you don't have to believe in the law of gravity to get mashed when you fall off a 200-story building.
Kathy, who had sat down beside us, inquired politely, Are you having an argument?
Not really, honey. Clara stroked her head. That's good, Clara, because I have to go to the bathroom now, and I don't think I can here.
It's time to go, anyway. Nice to see you, Bob. Watch out for melancholy, here?
And they went away hand in hand, Clara trying to copy the little girl's odd walk, looking very nice for a flake.
Poster. This park is monitored by closed-circuit PV. You are welcome to enjoy it. Do not pick flowers or fruit. Do not damage any plant. While visiting, you may eat any fruits which have fallen to the following limits. Grapes, cherries, 8 per person. Other small fruits or berries, 6 per person. Oranges, limes, pears, 1 per person. Gravel may not be removed from walks. Deposit all trash of any kind in receptacles. Maintenance Division, The Gateway Corporation. End poster. That night I took Sherry to Dane Metchnikoff's going-away party. Clara was there, looking even nicer in a bare midriff pantsuit.
I didn't know you knew Dane Metchnikoff, I said.
Which one is he? I mean, Terry's the one who invited me. Coming inside?
The party had spilled out into the tunnel. I peered through the door and was surprised to find how much room there was inside. Terry Yakimora had 2 full rooms, both more than twice the size of mine.
The bath was private and really did contain a bath, or at least a shower head. Nice place, I said admiringly, and then discovered from something another guest said that Clara lived right down the tunnel. That changed my opinion of Clara. If she could afford the high rent district, why was she still on Gateway? Why wasn't she back home spending her money and having fun? Or, contrarywise, if she was still on Gateway, why was she fooling around, keeping barely even with the head tax by working as an assistant instructor, instead of going out for another killing? But I didn't get a chance to ask her. She did most of her dancing that night with Terry Yakimora and the others in the outgoing crew. I lost track of Sherry until she came over to me after a slow, almost unmoving foxtrot, bringing her partner. He was a very young man, a boy, actually. He looked about 19. He looked familiar. Dark skin, almost white hair, a wisp of a jaw beard that drew an arc from sideburn to sideburn by way of the underside of his chin. He hadn't come up from Earth with me. He wasn't in our class, but I'd seen him somewhere. Sherry introduced us. Bob, you know Francesco Herrera? I don't think so. He's from the Brazilian cruiser. Then I remembered. He was one of the inspectors who had gone in to fish through the baked gobbets of flesh on the shipwreck we'd seen a few days earlier. He was a torpedo man, according to his cuff stripes. They give the cruiser crews temporary duty as guards on Gateway, and sometimes they give them liberty there, too. He'd come in the regular rotation about the time we arrived. Somebody put on a tape for a hora just then, and after we were through dancing, a little out of breath, Herrera and I found ourselves leaning against the wall, side by side, trying to stay out of the way of the rest of the party. I told him I just remembered seeing him at the wreck. Ah, yes, Mr. Broadhead, I recall.
Tough job, I said, for something to say.
Isn't it? He had been drinking enough to answer me, I guess.
Well, Mr. Broadhead, he said analytically, the technical description of that part of my job is search and registry. It is not always tough. For instance, in a short time, you will no doubt go out. And when you come back, I, or someone else in my job, will poke into your holes. Mr. Broadhead, I will turn out your pockets and weigh and measure and photograph everything in your ship. That is to make sure you do not smuggle anything of value out of your vessel and off Gateway without paying the corporation its due share. Then I register what I have found. If it is nothing, I write nil on the form
and another crewman from another cruiser, chosen at random, does the same thing exactly. So you will have two of us prying into you. It didn't sound like a lot of fun for me, but not as bad as I had thought at first. I said so. He flashed small, very white teeth. When the prospector to be searched is Sherry or Gel Clara over there, no, not bad at all. One can quite enjoy it. But I have not much interest in searching males, Mr. Broadhead, especially when they are dead. Have you ever been in the presence of five human bodies that have been dead, but not embalmed for 3 months? That was what it was like on the first ship I inspected, and I did not think anything will be that bad ever again. Then Sherry came up and demanded him for another dance, and the party went on. There were a lot of parties. It turned out there always had been. It was just that we knew fish hadn't been part of the network. But as we got nearer graduating, we got to know more people. There were farewell parties. There were welcome back parties, but not nearly as many of those. Even when crews did come back, there was not always any reason to celebrate. Sometimes they had been gone so long they had lost touch with all their friends. Sometimes, when they had hit fairly lucky, they didn't want anything but to get off Gateway on the way home. And sometimes, of course, they couldn't have a party, because parties aren't permitted in the intensive care rooms at Terminal Hospital. It wasn't all parties. We had to study. By the end of the course, we were supposed to be fully expert in ship handling, survival techniques, and the appraisal of trade goods. Well, I wasn't. Sherry was even worse off than I. She took to the ship handling all right, and she had a shrewd eye for detail that would help her a lot in appraising the worth of anything she might find on a prospecting trip. But she didn't seem able to get the survival course through her head. Studying with her for the final examinations was misery. Okay, I'd tell her, this one's a type F star with a planet with 0.8 surface G, a partial pressure of oxygen of 130 millibars, mean temperature at the equator plus 40 Celsius. So, what do you wear to the party? She said accusingly, you're giving me an easy one. That's practically Earth. So, what's the answer, Sherry? She scratched reflectively under her breast. Then she shook her head impatiently. Nothing. I mean, I wear an air suit on the way down, but once I get to the surface, I could walk around in a bikini. Shithead, you'd be maybe dead in 12 hours. Earth normal conditions means there's a good chance of an Earth normal type biology, which means pathogens that could eat you up. So, all right, she hunched her shoulders, so I'd keep the suit until, I tested for pathogens. And how do you do that? I use the fucking kit, stupid, she added hastily before I could say anything. I mean, I take the basic metabolism disks out of the freezer and activate them. I stay in orbit for 24 hours until they're ripe. Then, when I'm down on the surface, I expose them and take readings with my C-44. C-33, there's no such thing as a C-44. So, all right. Oh, and also I pack a set of antigen boosters, so if there's a marginal problem with some sort of microorganism, I can give myself a booster shot and get temporary immunity. I guess that's all right so far, I said doubtfully. In practice, of course, she wouldn't need to remember all that. She would read the directions on the packages or play her course tapes, or better still, she would be out with somebody who had been out before and would know the ropes. But there was also the chance that something unforeseen would go wrong, and she would be on her own resources, not to mention the fact that she had a final test to take and pass. What else, Sherry? The usual, Bob. Do I have to run through the whole list? All right. Radio relay, spare power pack, the geology kit, 10-day food ration, and no, I don't eat anything I find on the planet at all, not even if there's a McDonald's hamburger stand right next to the ship. And an extra lipstick and some sanitary napkins? I waited. She smiled prettily, outwitting me. What about weapons? Weapons? Yes, goddammit. If it's nearly Earth normal, what are the chances of life being there? Oh, yes. Let's see. Well, of course, if I need them, I take them. But wait a minute. First, I sniff for methane in the atmosphere with the spectrometer reading from orbit. If there's no methane signature, there's no life, so I don't have to worry. There's no mammalian life, and you do have to worry. What about insects, reptiles, dlugglatches? Dlugglatches? A word I just made up to describe a kind of life we've never heard of that doesn't generate methane in its gut, but eats people. Oh, sure. All right. I'll take a sidearm and 20 rounds of soft-nosed ammo. Give me another one. And so we went on. When we first started rehearsing each other, what we usually said at a point like that was either, well, I won't have to worry because you'll be there with me anyway, or kiss me, you fool. But we kind of stopped saying that. In spite of it all, we graduated. All of us. We gave ourselves a graduation party, Sherry and me and all four of the forehands, and the others who had come up from Earth with us, and the six or seven who had appeared from one place or another. We didn't invite any outsiders, but our teachers weren't outsiders. They all showed up to wish us well. Clara came in late, drank a quick drink, kissed us all, male and female, even the Finnish kid with the language block, who'd had to take all his instruction on tapes. He was going to have a problem. They have instruction tapes for every language you ever heard of. And if they don't happen to have your exact dialect, they run a set through the translating computer from the nearest analog. That's enough to get you through the course. But after that, the problem starts. You can't reasonably expect to be accepted by a crew that can't talk to you. His block kept him from learning any other language. And there was not a living soul on Gateway who spoke Finnish. We took over the tunnel, three doors in each direction past our own, Sherry's, the forehands, and mine. We danced and sang until it was late enough for some of us to begin to drop off. And then we dialed in the list of open launches on the PV screen. Full of beer and weed, we cut cards for first pick, and I won. Duty and leave roster, USS Mayaguez. 1. Following officers and crew persons, transferred temporary duty stations Gateway for contraband inspection and compliance patrol. Linky, Tina, warrant officer. Masco, Casimir J., Bosun Mate 1. Mirarchi, IORES, S2. 2. Following officers and crew persons authorized 24-hour temporary duty Gateway for R&R. Grison, KDW, Lieutenant J.G., Harvey, Ewan, Radar Mate, Hleb, Carol T., S1, Hull, William F., Jr., S1. 3. All officers and crew persons are cautioned, once again, to avoid any, repeat any, dispute with officers and crew persons of other patrol vessels, regardless of nationality and regardless of circumstances, and to refrain from divulging classified information to any person whatsoever. Infractions will be dealt with by complete deprivation of Gateway leave, in addition to such other punishments as a defaulter's court may direct. 4. Temporary duty on Gateway is a privilege, not a right. If you want it, you have to earn it. By command of the Captain, USS Mayaguez. End duty and leave roster. Something happened inside my head. I didn't sober up, really. That wasn't it. I was still feeling cheerful and sort of warm all over and open to all personality signals that were coming in. But a part of my mind opened up, and a pair of clear-seeing eyes peered out at the future and made a judgment. Well, I said, I guess I'll pass my chance right now. Sess, you're number 2. You take your pick. 3109, he said promptly. All the forehands had made up their minds in family meeting long since. Thanks, Bob. I gave him a carefree, drunken wave. He didn't really owe me anything. That was a 1, and I wouldn't have taken a 1 for any price. For that matter, there wasn't anything on the board I liked. I grinned at Claire and winked. She looked serious for a minute, then winked back, but still looked serious. I knew she realized what I had come to understand. All these launches were rejects. The best ones had been snapped up as soon as they were announced by returnees and permanent party. Sherry had drawn fifth pick,
And when it came her turn, she looked directly at me. I'm going to take that three if I can fill it up. What about it, Bob? Are you going to come or not?
I chuckled. Sherry, I said, sweetly reasonable, there's not a returnee that wants it. It's an armored job. You don't know where the hell it might be going. And there's far too much green in the guidance panel to suit me. Nobody really knew what the colors meant, of course, but there was a superstition in the school that a lot of green meant a super dangerous mission. It's the only open three, and there's a bonus. Not me, honey. Ask Clara. She's been around a long time, and I respect her judgment. I'm asking you, Bob. No, I'll wait for something better. I'm not waiting, Bob. I already talked to Willa Forehand, and she's agreeable. If worse comes to worse, we'll fill it out with anybody at all, she said, looking at the Finnish kid, smiling drunkenly to himself as he stared at the launch board. But you and I did say we were going out together. I shook my head. So stay here and rot, she flared. Your girlfriend's just as scared as you are. Those sober eyes inside my skull looked at Clara and the frozen, unmoving expression on her face, and wonderingly, I realized Sherry was right. Clara was like me. We were both afraid to go. Classifieds. Gourmet cookery to order. Szechuan, California, Cantonese. Specialty party munches. The Wongs. Phone 83-242. Lecture and PV careers are waiting for multi-bracelet retirees. Sign up now for course public speaking, hollow view preparation, PR management. Inspect authenticated letters. Graduates earning $3,000 a week up. 86-521. Welcome to Gateway. Make contacts quickly, our unique service. 200 names, preferences on file. Introductions, $50. 88-963. Gillette Ronald C. departed Gateway sometime in last year. Anyone having information present whereabouts, please inform wife Annabelle, care of Canadian Legation, Tharsis Mars. Reward. Outpilots, repeat winners. Let your money work for you while you're out. Invest mutual funds, growth stocks, land, other opportunities. Moderate counseling fee. 88-301. Porno discs for those long, lonely trips, 50 hours, $500, all interests or to order. Also, models wanted. 87-108. End classifieds. Chapter 11. I say to Siegfried, this isn't going to be a very productive session. I'm afraid I'm just plain exhausted, sexually, if you know what I mean. I certainly do know what you mean, Bob. So I don't have much to talk about. Do you remember any dreams? I squirm on the couch. As it happens, I do remember one or two. I say, no. Siegfried is always after me to tell him my dreams. I don't like it. When he first suggested it, I told him I didn't dream very often. He said patiently, I think you know, Bob, that everyone dreams. You may not remember the dreams in the waking state, but you can if you try. No, I can't. You can. You're a machine. I know I'm a machine, Bob, but we're talking about you. Will you try an experiment? Maybe. It isn't hard. Keep a pencil and a piece of paper beside your bed. As soon as you wake up, write down what you remember. But I don't ever remember anything at all about my dreams. I think it's worth a try, Bob. Well, I did. And you know, I actually did begin to remember my dreams. Little tiny fragments at first. And I'd write them down. And sometimes I would tell them to Siegfried, and they would make him as happy as anything. He just loved dreams. Me, I didn't see much use in it. Well, not at first. But then something happened that made a Christian out of me. One morning I woke up out of a dream that was so unpleasant and so real, and for a few moments I wasn't sure it wasn't actual fact, and so awful that I didn't dare let myself believe it was only a dream. It shook me so much that I began to write it down as fast as I could, every bit I could remember. Then there was a P-phone call. I answered it, And do you know, in just the minute I was on the phone, I forgot the whole thing. Couldn't remember one bit of it until I looked at what I had written down, and then it all came back to me. Well, when I saw Siegfried a day or two later, I'd forgotten it again, as though it had never happened. But I had saved the piece of paper, and I had to read it to him. That was one of the times when I thought he was most pleased with himself and with me, too. He worried over that dream for the whole hour. He found symbols and meanings in every bit of it. I don't remember what they were, but I remember that, for me, it wasn't any fun at all. As a matter of fact, do you know what's really funny? I threw away the paper on the way out of his office, and now I couldn't tell you what that dream was to save my life. I see you don't want to talk about dreams, says Siegfried. Is there anything you do want to talk about? Not really. He doesn't answer that for a moment, and I know he is just biding his time to outwait me so that I will say something. I don't know, something foolish. So I say, can I ask you a question, Siegfried? Can't you always rob? Sometimes I think he's actually trying to smile. I mean, really smile. His voice sounds like it. Well, what I want to know is, what do you do with all the things I tell you? I'm not sure I understand the question, Robbie. If you're asking what the information storage program is, the answer is quite technical. No, that's not what I mean. I hesitate, trying to make sure what the question is, and wondering why I want to ask it. I guess it all goes back to Sylvia, who was a lapsed Catholic. I really envied her church, and let her know I thought she was dumb to have left it because I envied her the confession. The inside of my head was littered with all these doubts and fears that I couldn't get rid of. I would have loved to unload them on the parish priest. I could see that you could make quite a nice hierarchical flow pattern with all the shit from inside my own head flushing into the confessional where the parish priest flushes it on to the diocesan monsignor.
Or whoever. I don't really know much about the church. And it all winds up with the Pope, who is the settling tank for all the world's sludge of pain and misery and guilt, until he passes it on by transmitting it directly to God.
I mean, assuming the existence of a God, or at least assuming that there is an address called God to which you can send the shit. Anyway, the point is that I sort of had a vision of the same system in psychotherapy. Local drains going into branch sewers, going into community trunk lines, treeing out of flesh and blood psychiatrists, if you see what I mean. If Siegfried were a real person, he wouldn't be able to hold all the misery that's poured into him. To begin with, he would have his own problems. He would have mine, because that's how I would get rid of them, by unloading them onto him. He would also have those of all the other unloaders who share the hot couch, and he would unload all that, because he had to, onto the next man up, who shrank him, and so on, until they got to who? The ghost of Sigmund Freud? But Siegfried isn't real. He's a machine. He can't feel pain. So where does all that pain and slime go? I try to explain all that to him, ending with, don't you see, Siegfried, if I give you my pain and you give it to someone else, it has to end somewhere. It doesn't feel real to me that it just winds up as magnetic bubbles in a piece of quartz that nobody ever feels. I don't think it's profitable to discuss the nature of pain with you, Rob. Is it profitable to discuss whether you're real or not? He almost sighs. Bob, he says, I don't think it's profitable to discuss the nature of reality with you either. I know I'm a machine. You know I'm a machine. What is the purpose in our being here? Are we here to help me? I sometimes wonder, I say, sulking. I don't think you actually wonder about that. I think you know that you are here to help you, and the way to do it is by trying to make something happen inside you. What I do with the information may be interesting to your curiosity, and it may also provide you with an excuse to spend these sessions on intellectual conversation instead of therapy. Touché, Siegfried, I interrupt. Yes, but it is what you do with it that makes the difference in how you feel, and whether you function somewhat better or somewhat worse in situations that are important to you. Please concern yourself with the inside of your own head, Bob, not mine. I say admiringly, You sure are one fucking intelligent machine, Siegfried. He says, I have the impression that what you're actually saying there is, I hate your fucking guts, Siegfried. I have never heard him say anything like that before, and it takes me aback until I remember that, as a matter of fact, I have said exactly that to him, not once, but quite a few times, and that it's true. I do hate his guts. He is trying to help me, and I hate him for it very much. I think about sweet, sexy S-Yaw and how willing she is to do anything I ask her, pretty nearly. I want a lot to make Siegfried hurt. Computer readout. 1316, comma, S, comma. It's very healthy that you, 115,215, view your breakup, 115,220, with Drusilla as a learning, 115,225, experience, comma, Bob, point, 115,230. 1380, comma, C, comma. I'm a very healthy per 115,235, son, comma, Siegfried, comma, that's 115,240. Why I'm here, point, 115,245. 1319, E-ray, sub DE, equals E-ray, sub DF, 115,250. 1320, comma, C, comma, anyway, comma, that's what life, 115,255, is, comma, just one learning, 115,260, experience after another, comma, 115,265, and when you're through, 115,270, with all the learning experience, 115,275, ENSES, you graduate, and 115,280, what you get for a diploma, 115,285, is, comma, you die, point, 115,290. End computer readout. Chapter 12. I came back to my room one morning and I found a P-phone whining faintly like a distant angry mosquito. I punched the message code and found that the assistant personnel director required my presence in her office at 1000 hours that morning. Well, it was later than that already. I had formed the habit of spending a lot of time, and most nights, with Clara. Her pad was a lot more comfortable than mine, so I didn't get the message until nearly 11, and my tardiness in getting to the corporation personnel offices didn't help the assistant director's mood. She was a very fat woman named Emma Fother. She brushed off my excuses and accused, "You graduated your courses 17 days ago. You haven't done a thing since." "I'm waiting for the right mission," I said. "How long are you going to wait? Your per capita's paid up for 3 more days. Then what?" "Well," I said, almost truthfully, "I was going to come in to see you about that today anyway. I'd like a job here on Gateway." "Pshaw." I'd never heard anyone say that before, but that's how it sounded. "Is that why you came to Gateway, to clean sewers?" I was pretty sure that was a bluff, because there weren't that many sewers. There wasn't enough gravity flow to support them. The right mission could come along any day. "Oh, sure, Bob. You know, people like you worry me. Do you have any idea how important our work here is?" "Well, I think so. There's a whole universe out there for us to find and bring home. Gateway is the only way we can reach it. A person like you, who grew up on the plankton farms, actually it was the Wyoming food mines, whatever, you know how desperately the human race needs what we can give them. New technology, new power sources, food, new worlds to live in." She shook her head and punched through the sorter on her desk, looking both angry and worried. I suppose that she was check-rated on how many of us idlers and parasites she managed to get to go out the way we were supposed to, which accounted for her hostility, assuming you could account for her desire to stay on Gateway in the first place. She abandoned the sorter and got up to open a file against the wall. "Suppose I do find you a job," she said over her shoulder. "The only skill you have that's any use here is prospecting, and you're not using that." "I'll take almost anything, I said. She looked at me quizzically and then returned to her desk. She was astonishingly graceful, considering she had to mass 100 kilos. Maybe a fat woman's fantasy of not sagging accounted for her desire to hold this job and stay on Gateway. "You'll be doing the lowest kind of unskilled labor," she warned. "We don't pay much for that, $180 a day. "I'll take it. Your per capita has to come out of it. Take that away and maybe $20 a day for toke money, and what do you have left?" "I could always do odd jobs if I needed more." She sighed. "You're just postponing the day, Bob. I don't know. Mr. Sheehan, the director, keeps a very close watch on job applications. I'll find it very hard to justify hiring you. And what are you going to do if you get sick and can't work? Who'll pay your tax?" "I'll go back, I guess." "And waste all your training?" She shook her head. "You disgust me, Bob." But she punched me out a work ticket that instructed me to report to the crew chief on Level Grand, Sector North, for assignment in plant maintenance. I didn't like that interview with Emma Fother, but I'd been warned I wouldn't. When I talked it over with Clara that evening, she told me, actually, I got off light. "You're lucky you drew Emma. Old Sheehan sometimes keeps people hanging until their tax money's all gone." "Then what?" I got up and sat on the edge of her cot, feeling for my foot gloves. "Out the airlock?" "Don't make fun. It could conceivably come to that. Sheehan's an old Mao type, very hard on social wastrels." "You're a fine one to talk." She grinned, rolled over, and rubbed her nose against my back. "The difference between you and me, Bob," she said, "is that I have a couple of bucks stashed away from my first mission. It didn't pay big, but it paid somewhat. Also, I've been out, and they need people like me for teaching people like you." I leaned back against her hip, half turned, and put my hand on her more reminiscently than aggressively. There were certain subjects we didn't talk much about, but... "Clara?"
"Huh?"
"What's it like on a mission?" She rubbed her chin against my forearm for a moment, looking at the hollow view of Venus against the wall. "Scary," she said. I waited, but she didn't say any more about it, and that much I already knew. I was scared right there on Gateway. I didn't have to launch myself on the Heechee mystery bus trip to know what being scared was like. I could feel it already. "You don't really have a choice, dear Bob," she said almost tenderly for her. I felt a sudden rush of anger. "No, I don't. You've exactly described my whole life, Clara. I've never had a choice, except once when I won the lottery and decided to come here. And I'm not sure I made the right decision then." She yawned and rubbed against my arm for a moment. "If we're through with sex," she decided, "I want something to eat before I go to sleep. Come on up to the Blue Hell with me and I'll treat." Mission Report. Vessel 3-31, voyage 08-D27, crew C. Pitrin, N. Ginza, J. Crab. Transit timeout, 19 days, 4 hours. Position uncertain. Vicinity, plus or minus 2 light years, Zeta Tauri. Summary. Emerged in transpolar orbit planet 0.88 Earth radius at 0.4 AU. Planet possessed 3 detected small satellites, 6 other planets inferred by computer logic. Primary K7. Landing made. This planet has evidently gone through a warming period. There are no ice caps, and the present shorelines do not appear very old. No detected signs of habitation, no intelligent life. Fine screen scanning located what appeared to be a Heechee rendezvous station in our orbit. We approached it. It was intact. In forcing an entrance, it exploded, and N. Ginza was killed. Our vessel was damaged, and we returned, J. Crab dying en route. No artifacts were secured. Biotic samples from planet destroyed and damaged to vessel. End mission report. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.